It's the size of a squash court, and it could be the brightest object in the night sky, excluding the moon.
But I am looking forward to the home gravitational wave detector to push the boundary back a bit.
All the planets are indeed moving away from the sun very, very slowly.
Hello, and welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
This month, we're celebrating the year in space, coincidentally, the title of our book, which is out next month, Izzy. Like, can you believe it's already here?
No. I'm so excited. Oh my God.
Me too, yeah. But in all honesty, it's just been a really exciting year for space exploration as well.
Yeah, plus the emails were piling up and we just needed to do something about it. So
that's the story of everybody's life.
So Becky and Robert are here as usual, but I've also decided to give our editor Richard Hollingham a microphone for this episode too.
Hello.
<he's> disembodied voice.
So I asked this in January and I enjoyed it so much that I want to do it again. Everyone, to start things off, what is your favorite space fact from this year that you can bring to the table?
I don't know if mine's a fact necessarily, but it's just a statement that we can now say that it's true, that a year ago would have just blown my mind. Like the idea that JWST is now finding galaxies at redshift 20. Like the fact that I can say that is insane. So when we're talking about redshift, we're talking essentially about how, you know, far the light has traveled, essentially. So how much it's been redshifted through the universe as the universe has expanded. So the bigger the number, the further distant the galaxy is. And, you know, last year you might have said, ooh, redshift 9, that's so high.
Yeah.
Now we're like, redshift 12, 15, maybe even 20.
I know.
Like, it's just insane.
The scientific term of being way, way far away.
Yes, very, very far away.
Robert, what about you?
Well, mine's definitely JWST-ish as well. But, I mean, frankly, the fact the thing launched successfully, deployed successfully, is unbelievable. And it's,
I mean,
such
that
an
is
achievement.
True.
I mean, you know, apart from my anxiety levels being a little high around the launch, around the deployment, all of those things, now it's just fantastic, an amazing, amazing, amazing achievement. In the very last week, there's been, I don't know, again, it's not necessarily a fact, but it's particularly interesting to me because when I did my PhD, which was back in the early 1990s, we looked at these forming planetary systems in the Orion Nebula, given the name Proplids for protoplanetary disks, and they were observed with Hubble at that time, and now JWST has done the same, and it's just the images out in the last week. You can see the kind of environment where the sun and the planets formed, which I think is just fantastic. And it's obviously particularly interesting to me, but I do recommend you look at the images if you haven't checked them out yet.
Nice. And Richard, you gave us pineapple cake last time. What have you got for us this time?
I've got a fact of the second. So it's the 45th anniversary just past of the launch of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And right now, their distance from Earth, so the distance from Earth of Voyager 1 is 14,672,936,483 miles.
Wow.
Can I have that in kilometres as well?
Oh, yeah, I can. Hang on.
No.
It's changed since I gave it to you in miles, but in kilometres, it's 23,613,810,000, and it's now 427.
And by the time this podcast goes out, this will be completely irrelevant.
it'll be an inaccurate fact.
Yes.
It's already an inaccurate fact.
We love
also,
it.
Also, when you said a fact of the second, I thought you meant, I was like, oh, we're going to learn something about seconds, like as in the minute of time. I was like, is it some anniversary of the definition of a second in SI units? No. Calm down, Becky.
Okay. Well, that's my silly question done, so we should probably get to the proper ones. So, Robert, can you start off with this one? As we said, the year began with the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. And, you know, we are still not bored of talking about it. And it seems that our listeners aren't either because we've had quite a few questions. So Fernando has emailed to ask, since JWST can look further back in time with its infrared lens, it made me consider, what if you could look back extremely far back in time, so much so that you could look back to the origin of the universe? What is the limit to how far telescopes can see? And could you hypothetically look at the start of the Big Bang?
Yeah, well, that is a good question, Fernando. And with, I mean, we shouldn't underestimate how far back JWST is looking. It's looking very, very far back, back to just 100 million years or so after the Big Bang. That's more or less the prediction that's being made for that, for when the very first stars and galaxies formed. Now, so we get light from those, but it's very redshifted, so we need an infrared telescope like JWST to detect them. And the absolute limit for that kind of radiation, so for photons, which is, you know, packets of electromagnetic radiation like light, infrared, radio waves, X-rays, gamma rays, that stuff, the limit is the cosmic microwave background, which is the time when the universe became transparent. So all the photons and so on, all the basically infrared heat was scattered at that point. It's a bit like looking at the surface of clouds, and you know, you can't see into the clouds, but you can see the light from the clouds coming down to the ground, which I have to say, sitting here in my study at home looking at a very gray sky, seems like a very appropriate analogy. You know, I can only see probably about a mile above my head, so we don't get to see inside them that well with that technique. But you could use things like gravitational waves to sort of look, in quotation marks, even further back and try and detect the disturbances that were going on in the universe even earlier back, so before about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And there is a team at the Stephen Hawking Center for Theoretical Cosmology in Cambridge that are working on this. And they, because those waves would be very high frequency, they'd have a short wavelength, you'd have to somehow come up with very small and very, very sensitive detectors, which we don't have yet. The detectors for gravitational wave are enormous. I mean, they're kilometers long, and they have to be because you're measuring a tiny, tiny disturbance in space-time. But the idea of that team, which I quite like, is that they could have something that could fit in your kitchen. Now, I think we're quite a long way from having, you know, home gravitational wave detectors, but I guarantee that if anybody comes up with an affordable one, I will consider it, yeah. And it will be on my Christmas list. I'm betting.
I was just about to say, I'll put that on mine as well, just for fun.
Can you imagine conversations like, but the microwave needs to go on the kitchen bench, Becky. No, not
exactly. And instead, we've got the gravitational wave detector. So, anyway, so that would get us back towards the Big Bang. How close you can get to that is, and then another question. You then get much more complicated ideas. And I guess we sort of simulate it. We try and simulate it with things like the Large Hadron Collider, where we smash particles together to simulate those kind of conditions. But the energies you need get higher and higher, and it gets harder and harder. So we can go at least theoretically further back than JWST and those telescopes that look at the cosmic microwave background, the satellites that did that. It just gets harder. But I am looking forward to the home gravitational wave detector to push the boundary back a bit.
Yeah, well, I think we all are. Sandra, Becky, we have this question from Young Good Postingman Brown, mm-hmm. who's tweeted to ask, has JWST changed ideas about cosmology with its early data?
So somewhat, in a way, yes, but not significantly in the way that some of you might have seen claimed online. So, I mean, there's a huge amount of misinformation online right now about many a topic, but specifically about JWST, as well as lots of pseudoscience articles claiming, for example, that JWST has somehow disproved the Big Bang theory, which is obviously, you know, sort of the foundation of cosmology, essentially. So this sort of origins of the universe. But that's, it's not the case at all, right? Especially because these articles are sort of written as the Big Bang never happened, but the Big Bang theory is basically the explanation for the entire 13.8 billion years of the past universe's history, which we know happened because, well, we're here. We can see it.
Yeah.
What JWST has revealed is that there are disk galaxies, so sort of spiral galaxies with these features that are flat at much higher redshifts, so at further distances away from us and therefore earlier in the universe because light takes time to travel to us. So the further distance something is, we're seeing it at a younger age in the universe. So we can see those now at higher distances, but we can also see these smaller galaxies as well at these higher distances or earlier times in the universe's history. And that's not a surprise because for Hubble, they're just fuzzy blobs, right? And we think they're fuzzy blobs, and with JWST, you can finally resolve them into the shape that they are. But of course, our models are based on what observations we have. We literally, that's what the simulations in theory all do, is try and match observations. So they match the observations we had, which was with Hubble, which showed fuzzy blobs then rather than disk galaxies. Now with JWST, yeah, we're going to have to tweak some of the models that in cosmology explain the evolution of the universe to give us smaller galaxies and more disk galaxies forming earlier on than we currently have them now. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the underlying things of modern cosmology, like, you know, the expansion of the universe or the fraction of dark matter and dark energy in the universe, change in any way. Like, they're not affected at all by these results from JWST yet anywhere. I mean, if they were, we'd be shouting the loudest from the rooftops because we'd be so excited by the fact that it was sort of showing that. And I think that's always how you can tell if something's a conspiracy theory online, because they're like, scientists are hiding this incredible result. And it's like, no, that's not no, what we do.
I'd be out there with my party poppers, yeah. You know. Yeah.
Are you keeping your Nobel Prize quiet then?
Though, yeah. She's lying to us, everyone. Oh, okay, thanks, Becky. And so, Richard, this next question is from Sam, and it's a little different for us. I mean, no need to be alarmed, everyone, but it's a biology question.
Astrobiology. Astrobiology. It comes under our
remit. Put astro in front of it. It was fine. But I think we should let Richard handle this one.
Hello, my name's Sam, and I'm 15 years old. I've recently learned about tropisms in biology, the influences on plant growth. And I was wondering how the lack or change in gravity would affect the growth and direction of roots of a plant on the ISS or orbiting a planet. And how would gravity or light influence a plant on the Moon or Mars with the possibility of cultivation on permanent bases?
Great question, Sam. I should explain, I have a degree in biology, which yeah. is why I've been handed this question.
We just palm everything else like, oh, I'm not sure, Richard.
Whoa, biology. Tropisms are great. So there's phototrophism, which is they almost like senses for plants. So phototrophism is the way plants lean towards light, seek out light, and you see that with trees and plants maybe in your garden. There's chemotrophism, which is a reaction to chemicals. Hydrotrophism, reaction to water. Love this one. Traumatrophism.
Oh, gosh.
Guess what that is, everyone?
Something I talk about with our therapists.
And then the response to gravity, which is either gravitropism, which is what we learned when I was at university, or it's also called geotropism. So response to gravity. So obviously you want the roots to grow down and the shoots to grow up. But it was a major concern with space and with humans living in space, well, what would happen to plants, particularly in microgravity on the space station? Now, there have been experiments for a good amount of time, really since the 1970s in a serious way. And gravity is really not the limiting factor. So plants do tend to just point towards the light. It affects the roots a little bit, but they grow pretty much okay. The big limiter, particularly in microgravity, is the soil or what you grow the plants in. You've got to make some sort of artificial soil. And then you've got the problem in microgravity that water tends to bubble. And then you can actually drown the plants. So the plants end up being drowned if you don't get that medium right. So that's really what's going to happen and what's happening now on the space station. And according to NASA, they have now successfully grown three types of lettuce, kale and flowers. I mean, kale! Of all the plants you're going to grow, all the things, you've got to be pretty desperate to crave kale,
I would
argue.
Which NASA hipster decided to grow kale on the International Space Station? They're like, I want my kale Caesar salad on the ISS.
Can I just recommend, though, another podcast, which has nothing to do with us, but there's one called, which is just the best name. There's a podcast by someone called Emma Doughty, and it's called Gardeners of the Galaxy podcast.
Oh my gosh. It's
so good because it goes into all this in some detail of the challenge of growing plants in space. So I would say, and coming back to Sam's question, when you're looking at growing plants on the Moon or Mars, assuming you've got the right conditions in terms of oxygen and water, shouldn't be a problem. The big limiter is going to be getting that soil right and stopping contamination.
Okay, so...
So that's a good... That biology degree finally paid off.
Yes! Okay, well, thanks for sorting that one out, Richard. So, Robert, we've had this question from Simon Whitaker via Hisan, and this is based on something that we talked about earlier in the year with our Gas Giants episode. So can you help with this? He says, and I apologise, g'day from Sydney.
Loved it.
Thank you. I was committed to my role. Firstly, thanks for the podcast. It's so good. I do have a question, though, from one of the podcasts. My son asked me this and I don't have an answer. I mean, that is what we're here for. Mm-hmm. If the moon was formed following a collision of an object with Earth and all the debris coalesced into the moon, Why will the rings of Saturn disappear in the future instead of forming a single or maybe multiple satellites? I think this is a great question. Mm.
Did my precious Saturn's rings disappear?
It is a great question. So, well, for the moon, the specific way in which it formed, we think, is that something big, something the size of Mars, which was given the name Theia, hit what you might think of as the proto-Earth, so the Earth before it became like the planet we have today. And that was a cataclysmic collision very early on in the solar system, so you can be reassured that these kind of collisions just can't happen now. You haven't got the same stuff around. But some of that, you know, a lot of that debris would have been chucked out into space entirely, you know, massively energetic collision. Quite a lot of it would have fallen back to the proto-Earth, and only a bit would have coalesced to form the moon. And the moon only has about an 81st the mass of the Earth, whereas, you know, the mass of the impactor would have been about a 10th of the mass of the Earth. So you can see quite a lot didn't go on to form the moon. And also the moon was outside what something called the Roche limit. And this comes to Saturn too. So the Roche limit is the point at which a satellite, generally something as big as a satellite, if it goes within that limit, and by satellite, I mean natural satellite moons, if it goes within that limit, it gets pulled apart by the differential gravitational field of the planet it's orbiting or the star too. And what you're looking at, if you imagine that one side of the moon has a stronger gravitational field than the other side, you get a differential force, it gets stretched and broken up. So there's a limit to how close a moon can be before it's pulled apart. And the moon was strong enough to overcome that, and it was far enough out. In the case of Saturn, though, what we think happened is that you had small asteroids and comets getting too close to the planet, being pulled apart because they were inside the Roche limit, and then creating the rings. And there's a really interesting debate going on as to how long they've been around. You know, the Cassini mission back in the 1990s and 2000s, and actually it only finished a few years ago, but that assumed that they were fairly recently formed, that they weren't that dark, and that, you know, they estimated the mass to be about the same as one of Saturn's moons, Mimas, which is
the Death Star.
The Death Star moon, yeah, it's the most reminiscently Death Star moon you can imagine. But now there's a debate saying, well, actually, it might be a bit higher. The rings might be a bit older. But whatever, they are sort of disappearing slowly because some of the dust of the inner ring debris is moving into Saturn's atmosphere and slowly drifting down. So over a period of time, they will disappear. We just don't know how long that is. So hopefully, I mean, they'll be around long enough, I think, that everybody listening to this podcast can rest assured that Saturn's moons will still be there. And if they're not there, then it's a conspiracy theory. Obviously, we're keeping quiet, but I'm joking about that quite clearly.
Why did you put that out
there? To go in the
frame
of these things, Saturn's rings are still there. I saw them two nights ago. I think they're there tonight.
Okay, so no need to worry too much, Becky. You're okay.
No. I mean, it's still cool that they're younger than the dinosaurs. It's like my favorite. I hope that doesn't go away if people like find that older, because I just want to keep saying that. Like, if dinosaurs had a telescope, they wouldn't have seen Saturn's rings.
and the lower limit is 10 million years old, which is, you know, if it was a few million years old, we'd be thinking, oh, the very first humans, had they had telescopes, wouldn't that be able to see them? But yeah, well, there seems to be this ongoing debate, including people in the UK, like Michelle Doherty, who's a, you know, really brilliant Cassini scientist. She was on a paper discussing the different hypotheses for the origins. So yeah, so don't quite know. But yeah, I like you. I like to think they're young and recent and stuff is going on in the solar system.
So as it's a book special, I think it's only appropriate that we do book club. So what's everyone been reading recently? What are your recommendations? Who wants to go first?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I can class this as reading.
Oh yes, I know exactly what you're going to say.
So I'm gonna go. I got a copy of Apollo Remastered by Andy Saunders, which is this great big giant coffee table book of remastered imagery from the Apollo missions. And oh my days, like, it's so beautiful. Like, to the point where, like, I've had people come over and I've just lost them for half an hour because they've just started opening this book. And I've been like, I'm going to give you that time to enjoy this, because it's just fabulous. It's so immersive and so crisp and clear. And yeah, I'd just recommend it for anyone. A great Christmas present, you know, if you want that really, like, chunky.
Well, it's definitely on my list, and I could see Richard is there like, I have something to say about this.
So we interviewed the author, Andy Saunders, on the Space Boffins podcast. He's fascinating. He's gone back to the original images from the Apollo missions, and also taken frames from the films that were on the spacecraft. Mm. And I think they're some of the most vivid of those images, seeing the astronauts sort of go about their daily lives in this tiny, cramped Apollo spacecraft, particularly during the Apollo 13 mission, where it was all going wrong. And they just look bored for the most part. But we've never seen that before. We've just got this impression of Apollo 13, I think, from the movie, more than we have from seeing the real astronauts in the spacecraft looking a bit bored and miserable. And then, I mean, the most extraordinary one for me, it's a marvelous book, is, again, we haven't seen this before, Neil Armstrong's face on the moon, actually seeing his face on the moon, because he took all the pictures. So there's loads of pictures of Buzz Aldrin on the moon, hardly any, apart from reflections, of Neil Armstrong on the moon. So actually see his face through the visor on the moon is just extraordinary. It's not a cheap book, but it's a beautiful book. I would absolutely, absolutely recommend it. No, it's superb. And and Space Boffins podcast for the Andy Saunders interview, he's very, very interesting. And the amount of work he's put into this, it's just incredible.
Oh, yeah. And there's a link to that interview in the episode notes if people want to listen to Space Boffins. Robert.
Of course they will.
Sorry.
When you want to listen to Space Boffins.
That was such a reach. Sorry. Robert, how about you? What are you bringing to book?
Well, I'm going to listen to Galaxy Gardeners before I listen to Space Boffins, I think.
But Gardeners of the Galaxy.
I'm one of those people that likes kale, but what can I say? Not everybody.
I'm glad you said that. So did I. I was like, I'm going to stay quiet.
So I'm going to reckon, assuming an old book is okay, I've got one from 1899. Now you might say, why on earth have I come up with this? So even older than me. But the reason is, a friend of mine was asking me questions about on social media about star names and where they come from, and most of them are Arabic, and then the Greeks giving names the constellations. That's the mythology we used to in the West, and of course there's loads of others around the world as well. And I was looking for the classic book on this, and one of the best ones is this Star Names, Their Lore and Meaning by Richard Hinckley Allen from 1899, which has been reprinted a lot. And it's beautiful, actually. I read through it and I thought, it is written in the language of the time. It does have some unfortunate descriptions of some parts of the world, but the details of it are great. And, so for example, Taurus, the constellation that we see in the sky right now, it quotes Virgil, it quotes poetry, when with his golden horns bright Taurus opes this year, and downward the crossed dog star stoops. And then it talks about the names of the different stars in the Pleiades and Hyades clusters, and that's just one constellation. It goes through the whole sky. So if you're wondering about all those exotic and beautiful sounding names that we give to stars or that we use in this podcast, this is a really great guide to describing them.
I'm guessing 1899, though, just that little bit too early to make some Harry Potter, Percy Jackson references to all of the star names.
It doesn't have those. It doesn't have wizard references. Not those things.
I'm not getting it then.
That's that.
I think this has been quite a different book club for us, to be honest, because I've got a book of poetry that I want to bring forward. So this was given to me by a friend for my birthday. And it's by Rebecca Elson, and it's called A Responsibility to Awe. And she was an astronomer and was diagnosed with a terminal cancer. And so this is a book on her poems, which are about the universe, but also with an element of time thrown into it as well. And it's lovely. It's one of those lovely books just to dip in and out of, I guess, similar, slightly smaller, very much smaller than the Apollo book. But it's really nice. I thought it was such a thoughtful present. And there's a lovely picture from the Juno mission on the cover as well. And I think it's a great book.
Lovely. Yeah.
So something a little bit different from our usual stuff. And I feel like we need to mention, not only do we have a book, but come on, Becky, let's throw another book into the pile. Come on.
I have my book out at the minute as well, A Brief History of Black Holes, essentially using the history of who figured stuff out and how did they figure stuff out so that you can understand what we know about black holes today much better. And with all the wit and pop culture references that I usually present my stuff with,
and
thrown
every
in there
Taylor
as well.
Swift
there is
a,
there is a
possible.
Good three Taylor Swift references in there, and there's some of them are very subtle, and if anyone can get them all, I'll be like, yes, gold star for you.
Gold star for you. Okay. And obviously we're gonna say it again, The Year in Space as well. When that's out and you fancy dipping in and out of something about this year in space. So shall we get back to some questions? Another big thing for the space community this year, well, and for all of us, was the image of the black hole at the centre of our galaxy. So, Becky, we've had this question from Jesse Rees. As an aspiring future astrophysicist, I love the podcast so much. Oh, thank you. And it makes me think, hence this question. We know there's evidence for a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy. However, could it be that there is a supermassive black hole in the middle of the universe which galaxies orbit around? I'm not sure whether we know the answer, so I thought I would ask. I love this question.
I love it too. It's so amazing. I mean, it's great to hear from an aspiring astrophysicist as well. Like, good luck with all your studies. And thanks for listening. So I think before we answer if there's a supermassive black hole at the center of the universe, we need to answer, is there even a center of the universe? which we don't think there is, right? At least from the visible universe that we can see, which is obviously the universe has only been around for 13.8 billion years. So light has only had that amount of time to travel to us. So there is an edge of the universe almost to what we can see that we call the observable universe. But there is probably a lot beyond that. And so we don't know, you know, whether the universe is infinite or not infinite, or even if it has a size or a shape or whatever. And from what we can see in terms of the structure, there is no center of the universe. And I think people get a little bit confused when we sort of talk about the Big Bang and expansion of the universe, like the expansion isn't happening from a point outwards like an explosion. All of space is always expanding. So it's expanding everywhere all at once. So there is no center of the universe. But if we look at sort of the structure of the universe, so when we look out and we map all the positions of the galaxies, we end up with the structure that we call the cosmic web. It kind of looks like almost like a sponge, right? You've got all these filaments and voids and big clusters of galaxies lumped together in certain points as well. And when we look at that structure, we've never been able to find a center, even a gravitational center where there's something that's heavier than everything else, right? And I guess that's how we probably think about a center, especially if we're thinking about if there's a supermassive black hole there, we're thinking about where's the gravitational driving seat almost, right? And we've never found anything like that in the structure. But if we do look for our local area of the universe, so the Milky Way, Andromeda, we're in the local group, but the local group is part of a bigger supercluster of galaxies as well, that's sort of our little sort of node of this structure of the universe. At the center of that is Messier 87. And the center of Messier 87 is Messier 87's supermassive black hole that we got the first image of a black hole from a few years ago. So before we had the image of the one at the center of the Milky Way this year, they first released the first big orange donut back in, I think it was 2017, of Messier 87's black hole. So I guess if we're thinking small scale, and I use small scale very loosely there as an astrophysicist, I guess it's Messier 87's black hole. But if we're thinking about the universe as a whole, there is no center and there's no supermassive black hole there.
Okay, well, thanks for clearing that up, Becky. And so, Robert, you know, next month we will be talking about planetary defense, given there's this current mission called DART that's aiming to redirect an asteroid.
That is not a danger to us.
That is not a danger to us.
Having to say this, it's a test.
It's a test.
It's a test.
It's a test to see that if one day we really needed to, you know, how do we do that?
Could we do it?
Yeah. So it's hopefully done that by the time we release this episode. But Robert, Alex Pimentel from California has a question about asteroid formation. And finally, someone has used my official title.
I love this.
They say, hi, Dr. Becky, Honourable Izzy and Dr. Massey. Yes, thank you.
That's fully your title now. Thank the Honourable Izzy. I'm going to, with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst and science journalist, Honourable Izzy Clark.
Thank you very much.
That'll be the new introduction to the podcast. Get used to it.
Yeah, okay. Alex has a question about the formation of asteroids. I understand the solar system condensed and coalesced out of a cloud of gas and dust. And I can imagine how the sun, planets and other bodies gradually accreted more and more mass, but I can't seem to wrap my brain around how asteroids formed into rocks. Since they don't have enough mass to pull themselves into a sphere, how did they become solid rocks? Is it merely a result that those dust and gas particles collided at a very high speed, or were they once a part of another larger object that was formed and subsequently smashed apart? Or are they not solid and more like a collection of gravel? That would still pose the question, how did pebbles form? They've thought a lot about this, and I really enjoy
this. This keeps them awake at night, doesn't it?
It's very good. It's very good. By the way, on Becky's question, I do like the fact that we're all in some way at the centre of the universe.
Yes, you
know, the observable universe.
We're all special. Yeah. The observable universe, being specific. But it's a great question, actually. And it's so, Alex, and we'll continue to refer to Izzy with that title, obviously. So if you think about the dust that's even in your house, it sticks together fairly easy. I mean, I don't, you know, most of us, if we look under the sort of less vacuumed bit of our houses, we will find little clumps of dust, and they stick together with the electrostatic forces, basically charge forces. That happens in space a bit as well, and they can stick together fairly easily when they're small. But you're right that there is a challenge when they get a bit bigger, and there's something called the bouncing barrier, which is where they get sort of pebble-sized, and if they crash into each other at high speed, you know, do they just break apart? Do they bounce off? How do they stick together? So it turns out, and this is where, you know, this is an experiment I'd really like to have had fun with, that there were some scientists, some astronomers, used a shot tower in Bremen in Germany, and they fired a container full of glass beads up to the top of this 120-meter high chamber. And so it went all the way up and then all the way down. Presumably it was, they were filming it, or I'm just thinking what happened to the glass when it hit the bottom again. But they filmed that the glass particles in that free fall environment would stick together a bit, with millimeter sized clumps would stick together under the influence of electrostatic forces. So they think that is sort of enough in the right circumstances to overcome some of that bouncing barrier, but it is still a bit of a problem. And then once they're big enough, of course, you're quite right, the gravity will pull them together. And if you end up with a large enough object, big asteroids, dwarf planets or full-sized planets, then you get internal heating and they all coalesce together and melt and so on. But the smaller objects, some of them are a bit like rubble piles. We think they are less coagulated together. So it varies depending on the size of the object, but certainly things like comets can be much more fragile, and we see that with all the missions we've sent to them.
That's what they're wondering for the DART mission as well, is when it impacts with this asteroid, like what is going to happen?
Yeah.
Because if it is just a rubble pile, then an impact could, you know, disrupt
could
it more.
Throw out a cloud of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Rather than just sort of imparting all this energy to the one piece of it. So yeah, I'm really excited to see what the DART mission finds, and it'll hopefully reveal a bit more about structure of asteroids too.
But personally, I would like to be one of those physicists, you know, throwing, for work, throwing containers up 120 metres high. Like, it just sounds
you'd
great.
You'd be like, where's Robert? Oh, don't mind him. He's just throwing some stuff. Yeah.
Just doing what every kid wants to do. Do you want to push this button? Hell yes, yeah. I do. Yes,
like, have you ever seen How Ridiculous on YouTube? It's these three Australian guys that go to this like sort of leaning tower outside of Perth and drop stuff. For
love
the
that.
Sake of like it's an observatory and like a whole science center where like, you know, kids in schools can go and do like experiments with gravity, but they're like, yeah, but what if we did all the cool stuff that you never think to do in science?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know, like remake Thor's hammer and drop it on a car and film it, and so or drop it on like a balloon or like paint canisters.
That is, yeah,
it's
that's
science,
a teacher's dream,
but it's
research dream.
Yeah, absolutely. So Richard, regular listeners, the Bath Astronomers, have sent in a question.
Oh, shout out Bath Astronomers, we love Bath Astronomers.
Richard, and so you do a lot of reporting on space flight and satellites, so can you help with this one? And they've asked, is the astronomy community losing the battle with satellite light polluters with the new Starlink getting brighter again as designs change and the launch of Blue Walker 3? So just to explain to anyone who may not have heard about Blue Walker 3.
Yeah, I missed this.
This is a large satellite from a Texas-based company called AST Space Mobile. And it's
mobile.
Mobile.
If you're American.
Or mobile.
Space mobile.
Space mobile. I did wonder that, actually. As I got to that word, I was like, are we doing another accent? No, we're not. But basically, Blue Walker 3 is essentially a massive dish that is going to be a cellular broadband network for mobile phones. It's the size of a squash court, and it could be the brightest object in the night sky, excluding the moon. So, you know...
What, they're permanently as well? Because when we apply for telescope time, we're like, I need dark skies. I need new moon skies to do the science I do. If there's something as bright as the moon in there permanently, that's absolutely going to mess up so much professional astronomy.
Hence the question. So, Richard and Robert.
Richard, tell me some good news.
Richard and Robert. Let's start with Richard. What do you think?
Well, I've recently been on my BBC Impartiality refresher course, so I'm going to give a very balanced answer. to this. And then Robert's going to put the perspective, I think, of the astronomy community, which I suspect will be less balanced.
A less balanced answer.
So the pros of all these satellites, they are connecting the world. They're filling in the gaps with internet connectivity, with mobile connectivity. I mean, the most famous, of course, is Starlink. They're now getting on about 3,000 Starlink satellites. I was trying to find the exact number earlier, but it kind of changes by the week almost. And you've also got these constellations of satellites, small satellites for climate change monitoring, forestry monitoring, pollution, agriculture. So they're doing lots of good things. On the downside, here's the BBC impartiality course kicking in, they're reflecting light, as Becky mentioned. And there's the other issue is the radio frequencies they're using. So, you know, they're blasting the sky with all these different frequencies. So it's problematic for radio astronomy. And, you know, from, again, this, you know, balanced perspective, there is pretty much open warfare going on within the space agencies, I use the term collectively, between the astronomy community and the tech community. Looking at, you know, the tech community want more of these satellites because they provide services which benefit people, and the astronomy community, which absolutely does not want these satellites, particularly ones that reflect light. And to be fair to Starlink, they've painted them darker, a lot of them, but there are an awful lot of them. When you look at a map of all the Starlink satellites, it's quite terrifying just how many. They are small, but they're, you know, there are a lot of them, and you've got these other constellations like OneWeb, for example. So it's a problem, and it's although radio frequencies are very much regulated at an international level and monitored, there are lots of international agreements on how many satellites you can stick up, but really there's no enforcement of it. So yeah, it's a growing problem, and if I was going to put an opinion on this, I say yes, the astronomy community is losing the battle at the moment.
That's not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say something a little bit. The astronomy community is.
Well, yes, there's words we can't use on a family podcast. Yes.
Robert, what do you think about this?
Well, this is part of my day job, trying to campaign on this. So I think I'd start by saying, look, nobody wants to say hinder communications. You know, we do accept the idea that remote areas need to be connected, that there are uses for the emergency services and all of those things. But there are quite a lot of developments in this that are concerning for astronomers and anybody who cares about the appearance of the night sky. And I think the AST satellite is supposed to be, I think, about the brightness of Venus, so probably brighter than the International Space Station is in the sky. And you have to ask, well, if there are multiple satellites like this, how much of an impact that will have on the view that we have regularly, let alone anything else. And it is then obviously problematic for astronomers trying to image the sky. They have to know when this thing is coming and avoid it. But Starlink are also now proposing, SpaceX and the Starlink system, they're now proposing their Generation 2 system, which will have another 30,000 satellites, which will also be bigger. And there's currently a filing with the Federal Communications Commission in the US, which regulates US satellite launches, to discuss this, and whether or not, you know, that goes ahead remains to be seen. But my guess is they probably will grant permission, so we're going to have even more of them. And at the high end, by the end of the decade, you know, we could be seeing 100,000-200,000 satellites like this in these giant constellations. Now, I think it's in a lot of cases they're small, you know, they have been darkened, although then they changed the system on that, because making the Starlink satellites darker, the first generation made them hotter, which wasn't a great surprise. Then they put these visors in to shield some of the reflection, and the problem with that was they couldn't, you know, then use the laser system to communicate between the satellites. They dropped that idea, and now I understand there's another darkening system being tried out. But I really hope that those remain in place, because even those are not absolutely adequate. You know, you can still see the satellites. And I suppose I put the idea that if you go to a very dark sky site and maybe 10% of the things you see in the sky, or maybe more, are moving satellites, you know, what is that doing to our cultural heritage, to that view we've enjoyed of the night sky for the whole of the time humanity's been on Earth? So, you know, I do think it's a reasonable point to make that it shouldn't just be satellite operators that get to decide this. And then, yes, there's the impact on astronomy, which will become a bit more expensive, at least as a result. And some things like finding near-Earth asteroids, for example, are a bit harder, because we see those as streaks on images that we have. And if you have lots of satellites moving around, which also look like streaks, it's a bit harder to disaggregate them. And also, if you're trying to do things like detect meteors in the sky with all sky cameras, you have a similar problem. So I do think we have to take it seriously. And on radio as well, there's another issue, which is that although Richard's right that it's regulated, a lot of radio astronomy is outside those regulated bands. They were only drawn up in the early 1960s, at the very beginning of the science. And of course, now we want to look across the whole spectrum. And we've got round that by putting observatories in very remote places, like the Square Kilometre Array sitting in Australia and Southern Africa. But you can't do that. It's not remote if there's satellites above you, because you see them everywhere on Earth. So I would say we're in a difficult stage of the battle. I'm not prepared to accept that we're losing it yet. We are it is being discussed at, and I say we, no, I'm not doing that, but it is being discussed at the United Nations, for example, and in other fora to try and get a better regulatory framework, or at least good practice guidelines in place that hopefully these satellite companies will start to observe and think about the fact that, you know, they're not the only community. It's not just about getting mobile phone reception right.
Yeah.
I think the issue at the moment is we're essentially relying on, or astronomy community is essentially relying on, the goodwill of Elon Musk and the other entrepreneurs.
I would prefer to do something about it. Thank you.
So that is the big, you know, the international regulation is sadly lacking. I think as well, I'm going to put this out here now, we should do a whole podcast on this.
Sounds good to me. I will rant away, I warn
because
you.
Because I could talk for ages on this.
It will depress me intensely, and I will prepare for that accordingly.
Okay, we'll be measured. Well,
get ready for that one, everyone. Okay, well, obviously, still a lot to consider there. So we'll circle back to that topic maybe another time. But Becky, we've had this question from Ray Gorman, and they've said... Mm-hmm. A recent discoverer of the podcast after trying to find science programs that educate without making me sleepy. I think this one works. I hope it does.
We laugh too much, don't we? Yeah. we keep people on their toes, Izzy. It's fine.
I like the word think in there. You know, I think it's qualified, isn't it? It's not emphatic.
Yeah, I know. I think this works.
Right, Ray, if you're asleep, wake up.
We're trying our best here. They said, I do have a question that I was wondering about. I know the moon has moved away from Earth over time, and interacting tidal forces have slowed the Earth's rotation down as a result, or vice versa, as it may be. Now, is the same true for the planets and tidal interactions with the sun? Are the planets slowly migrating away from the sun in a similar manner? If so, how long before it's dark at noon? And if not, then why not?
Love that. Dark at noon.
Yeah, I know. I don't want that. No,
no.
Thank you.
No, thank you. But yes, right, all the planets are indeed moving away from the sun very, very slowly. And there is an aspect of tidal interactions, but not necessarily between the sun and the planets. It's more sort of like the planets and everything else in the solar system. So for example, like Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, like they all pull on Earth ever so slightly, and there is sort of that slowing and moving outwards. But the biggest effect is for the fact that the sun is losing mass all the time. And I think sometimes we forget about this, right? Is that the sun, by, you know, in its core, nuclear fusion going on, where you have hydrogen, you know, four atoms of a hydrogen turned into an atom of helium, and that's what the sort of main energy production in the sun is that an atom of helium is slightly lighter than four atoms of hydrogen, which is great for us because it means energy is given out in the form of heat and radiation, which, hooray, we can survive on Earth because of it. But that does mean it's losing a tiny bit of mass with every single sort of fusion reaction it that happens. Like, the number is 4.7 million tons a second.
A second? That's a lot.
It's an insane number, right? So, I mean, it sounds like a lot, but in terms of the entire mass of the sun, which is what, 10 to the 30 kilograms, which is a one with 30 zeros after it, it's obviously a drop in the ocean, but still it's enough to disrupt that sort of orbit of the Earth and sort of slowly spiral it outwards. So the Earth is moving away from the sun because the sun is essentially getting ever so slightly lighter, and that obviously upsets the balance. And it's about 1.5 centimeters per year that the Earth moves away from the sun, or 0.00001 percent of the Earth's sun distance. So when I said very slowly, I meant very slowly. So as for Ray's question about when it would be dark at noon, that sort of puzzled me a little bit because I was like, well, how far away would you have to go for it to be dark at noon? Because on Mars, we see images from, you know, Curiosity rover and Perseverance rover and everything like that, you know, on the surface of Mars, that it's not dark at noon there. So you'd presumably have to go further away than the orbit of Mars. And I was like, well, how far away? I was like, well, let's be conservative and say Jupiter, right? Because Jupiter's pretty far away. It's actually 741 million kilometers away from the sun, which is a change of 591 million kilometers from where we currently are. And at the speed of 1.5 centimeters per year, that would take 39.4 trillion years. Is a little bit longer than the 13.8 billion that the universe has been around for. Out of curiosity, to get to Mars's distance, it would take 5 trillion years. So, to be honest, well, let's think about it. The sun has only 5 billion years left of its lifetime. So we're not going to get that far.
That's what I was literally just about to say. I was like, yeah, but we need to go back to the sun again because, you know.
Yeah.
Let's look at the lifetime there. Okay.
So thankfully, I don't think it's ever going to get dark at noon.
Hooray.
Ever, for on the Earth at least. We will only shift in the 5 billion years the sun's got left for about 75,000 kilometers, which is about 0.05% of the current Earth's sun distance.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up, Becky. Well, thank you to everyone who has sent in their questions. And Robert, obviously, we have to round things up with, what can we see in the night sky this month?
Well, not in the night sky, but in the daytime sky on the 25th of October, there's actually a partial eclipse of the sun, and that's visible from the UK, quite a lot
partial
of Europe.
Partial eclipse of the
partial
sun.
Eclipse, yes. It doesn't have quite
that
the same...
That was necessary, sorry. Yeah,
it doesn't quite...
Of course you did.
It's not quite as evocative, is it? So the 25th of October, anyway, and it's a time when the Earth, Moon and Sun are almost exactly in line, so you get the moon blocking out some of the sun. Now, from London, it'll be about 15% of the sun is blocked by the moon. It starts at 10:08 in the morning. Maximum eclipse is at 10:59 and it ends at 11:51. If you wanted somewhere in the world where it's much more covered, you'd have to go to Siberia, where up to about 4/5 of the sun is covered. But what I should stress in this is that, firstly, you would think 15% of the sun, oh, it'll be obviously darker. Actually, it won't, because even if it's a beautifully clear sky, your eye is so good at adapting to daylight that you just won't notice any difference. But the other really important point to make, which I cannot stress enough, is that this is not something you should look at, just stare at with your eyes, because it's still incredibly dangerous to sit and look at the sun, let alone, say, look at it through a telescope without the appropriate filters. So if you want to view it, I mean, firstly, I hesitate to say do your research online, but do good research. Look at respectable astronomy sites that tell you how to do it safely. The guidance is that what you would do is project the sun with a small telescope onto card or binoculars. You can do the same with that. Or you can buy a certified solar filter that goes over the front of your telescope or binoculars, not over the eyepiece. Those are very dangerous. They can crack and then they can let the light into your eye, and you can easily get permanent damage to your eyes. Or you can, if you have them and they're in date and they're not damaged and all of those things, if you have eclipse glasses, if you've seen a solar eclipse fairly recently, then that is another way to do it. But whatever you choose to use, please be very careful and follow the safety advice. Another suggestion is, if there is an astronomy society in your area, they might be running some sort of little event where they set up telescopes properly and safely, and you can just go along and look at it that way. But it is a nice event.
Or the calendar. Don't forget
the
calendar.
Well, the calendar is really difficult. Yeah, it's really difficult with partial ones, although I guess it's something we should try to see how it works. But yeah, little tiny pinholes is a way to do it too. But it's a bit harder when it's very partial, but it does work, and there's guidance on doing that. So apart from that, in the night sky, Mars is getting closer to opposition in December. It's getting closer, bigger and brighter, so do look for that.
Love Mars.
Should be surely Becky's second favorite planet after Saturn, at least, and the Earth, obviously. I do hope so.
No, it's Neptune.
Is it Neptune?
It's
got a ring. It's
because it's got a ring. I bet.
Well,
someone told me that I was the
Mars.
Opposite of Beyonce the other day on Twitter. They said that, like, if you wanted me to like it, then you should have put a ring on it.
Poor old Mars. What can I say? Mars is getting closer, bigger and brighter. It's really hard to see details on Mars, but every couple of years or so when it's close to the Earth is a really good time to do it. So if you've got a decent-ish telescope, now is the time to look at it. Saturn's still there in the evening sky as well. Beautiful ring system, always glorious. And Jupiter's only just past its very best. So it's really bright at the moment, and it's really obvious in the evening sky as the sun sets. It's already pretty high, moves around to the south, you know, pretty decent view of it right now. And it's a really good time to look for not just the weather systems on the planet, but also things like when the moons move in front of it. So the so Io, for example, the innermost moon, will move in front of Jupiter in the evening of the 18th of October. And you can see both the moon and its shadow moving across actually fairly easily. So if you've never done that, that's a really nice thing to look at. And then in the sky, you know, beyond that, you've got a meteor shower, the Orion meteor shower on the 21st, 22nd of October. Worth taking a look for that. Not vast numbers, but some of them can be quite bright. And the stars themselves, thinking of that Star Names, Their Lore and Meaning book, it's a nice time to look out for constellations like Pegasus and the big square it shares with Andromeda. With the galaxy that Becky was talking about earlier on, this is the time of year to look for the Andromeda galaxy, which, you know, if it was closer to the Earth or if it was brighter, it would be six times as big as the full moon. But because it's relatively faint, there's, you know, although it's the light of a whole galaxy, it's fairly spread out. It's faint, but you can see it with your eye, and it's just satisfying to pick up a pair of binoculars and see it as this long, well, you don't see the spiral arms very easy, but you do see this long fuzz, and to realize you're looking at a system of hundreds of billions of stars. And then, you know, there are other clusters in the sky as well. Perseus above Andromeda, another part of that whole Greek legend system, has this beautiful double cluster in it too. So a few things to look out for. Obviously you need maps to find some of these things, but I definitely recommend the solar eclipse observed safely, definitely recommend the planets, and yeah, take a look at galaxies and clusters. And as it gets colder in the autumn, it's a nice time to be doing these things.
Oh, absolutely. So basically just look up
as ever. As ever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Enjoy the view.
Isn't there like a massive thing for having fire pits and like chimneys outside right now to sit outside in autumn? Like, you know, crack out the fire pit, light a fire, look
such
up.
Such a nice time of year. I mean, he says looking out of his window at the rain, but you know, when it's clear and dry, it's absolutely stunning, let's face it.
Yeah, amazing. Well, that's it for this episode. And by the next time you'll hear from us, we'll have published our book. Woo! So, oh my God, can you
hype
tell
squad,
we're excited?
Hype squad.
So, yeah, The Year in Space, it's going to be out on the 27th of October. So do consider pre-ordering it if you haven't done already. And I just want to take this moment to say that I actually think it's quite wild that we are the number one astronomy podcast in the UK, and even more so that we have a book. So thank you to anyone that has listened, supported us, yeah, sent in questions. Like, we had no idea it would lead us to this point. So honestly, thank you so much. And thank you also to Lindsay and Alex from Headline Publishing Group, who have been huge supporters and getting this book off the ground. Thank yous all round, basically.
Should we tell people what's in the book as well? I feel like we haven't actually said.
Well, it's basically lots and lots of really interesting articles about the big space stories from this year. So I've written about the launch of JWST, and also talking about, 10 years of exploring Mars as well. I mean, the whole gang's been involved in it. So what else has anyone
there's
else?
Stargazing from Robert in there. There's like Ask Dr. Becky sections, right, as well. So if your question that you sent in hasn't been answered in a podcast, it might have been answered in the book instead.
Absolutely. And can I just say, there is a great guide to how to use a telescope and what to look out for in the night sky, you know, by a month breakdown. The illustrations as well are amazing. We've got loads of pictures just from Hubble and James Webb. I mean, we really fought to get, just delay printing so we can get those pictures. So
exactly.
And for the first time, if I can just interject, for the first time, it has the full interview that I did with Gene Cernan, Last Man on the Moon, which was recorded shortly before he passed away. So we've got that as well. It's so good to publish it for the first time, have the opportunity to put it all out there for the first time, written as a Q&A. So it's pretty much every word he said in that interview to me, and it's absolutely fascinating.
So I'm going to call that an exclusive.
Yeah, I think it is. I've been holding on to that interview, and I've sort of used bits and pieces over the years, but it's the first time we can actually put the whole lot
together. I'm going to give a plug for my friend Greg, who's done some of the illustrations really, really nicely. And
thanks, Greg.
Yeah. So he's not going to get much of a mention, but he definitely deserves it for that.
Well, big up, Greg. Well, if you fancy seeing what all the fuss is about, then the link to order the book is in our show notes. notes. Next time, we're going to be chatting about planetary defense and the DART mission. How the heck do we keep asteroids from colliding with our planet and not end up in some Hollywood disaster movie style thing where it breaks into two pieces and one's going to hit? Anyway, we don't want that. We'll find out in that next month's episode. But until then, happy stargazing.